We're happy to make podcasts available for selected EdWebinars for your listening pleasure. If you'd like to receive a CE certificate, you must watch the video recording and take the corresponding CE quiz. Recordings and quizzes can be found in the EdWebinar archives. Please visit home.edweb.net/podcasts for more information.
Welcome, everyone. We're excited to have you today here at our latest webinar, Navigating the Digital Shift, Equitable Learning Opportunities for All Learners. And we're happy to have you here. Looks like we have a great crowd. I'm here, Christine Fox, Deputy Executive Director with CEDA, and we have a special guest, Sean Joyce, who is a Technology Director for the North Palos School District in Illinois. We encourage you to join our Essential Element for Digital Content. This is an online community, so all of the resources that CEDA develops and all of the webinars that we participate in with EdWeb are hosted there. You can also get the chat log as well as the slide decks, etc. So just a little about myself. My name is Christine Fox. I'm the Deputy Executive Director with CEDA. I coordinate CEDA's professional learning opportunities for state leaders, as well as lead and manage our research and development of resources such as the one we're going to talk about today. My roots come from the classroom as an ESOL and third grade teacher, and I was also a curriculum coach. So I'm going to share a little about CEDA. Then you'll hear an overview from me about this new report, National Trends Report, regarding digital instructional materials. And then we will hear the district perspective from Sean Joyce, who will talk about how their district has shifted to digital learning opportunities. And then we'll have an open dialogue of Q&A. We would like to thank the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation for supporting this work and have been ongoing CEDA partner. So those of you not familiar, CEDA is a nonprofit organization. It's a membership organization that serves U.S. state-level educational technology, digital learning leaders, and we work to increase the capacity of state and national leaders around digital learning initiatives. We provide an opportunity to advocate for digital learning resources. We provide professional learning opportunities for our members, and we engage in interstate collaboration as well as public-private partnerships. So we have a very strong partnership with the private community, and our states are regularly depending on one another to learn more about what's going on across the country. So we put our members into three buckets: the state leaders, so leaders typically from state education agencies from all 50 states, District of Columbia, Virgin Islands, Guam, and American Samoa. Then our partners, as I just mentioned, come from the private sector, both for-profit and nonprofit. And then we also have affiliate organizations. So those are regional or statewide organizations, as well as higher education, international, and district level affiliates. So my colleagues will be posting links to all these in the chat so that you can learn more about potentially an organization that you work with participating in CEDA. So CEDA regularly advocates for digital learning opportunities. This is our fourth iteration of Navigating the Digital Shift. We also publish resources around broadband implementation, though from the state leadership side, as well as the broadband capacity and the level of broadband needed to support digital learning opportunities. And then we also have a guide to quality instructional materials, and that is an online resource. So we're constantly developing new resources based on requests from states and leaders from our own organization as well as others. So today we're here to celebrate the fourth iteration of Navigating the Digital Shift, Equitable Learning Opportunities for All Learners. And this is an exciting publication for us, even though we have published a variety of versions of this. Each time is a learning for all of us. Things have changed over the last 4 years or so since we initially published this work, but there are many things for us to keep working on, and we're happy to be able to share this resource with you. But before we get into the details, I wanted to reflect on the why. So you see some photos here. One is of my middle school aged daughters, and one is of our new executive director's granddaughter. And truly, we're here for our own families, but for all students and children across the country. All of these work around policies and practices can get painstaking at times, and we kind of can get caught up in the moment, or sometimes the frustration or even the joy of things working. But we want to give equitable learning opportunities for all students across the country, from all backgrounds and from all economic settings. And we're really here for the kids. And that may sound cliche, but it is also critical that we really think about the why as we go through our work, because it can get really easy to remove ourselves from that and forget about who we're working for. So as with all work and all of CETA's projects, we depend on collaborative leadership. We worked with state-level digital learning leaders from the SEAs, the state education agencies. We also worked with state instructional materials leaders that are part of state education agencies, particularly SIBRA, which is the State Instructional Materials Review Association. Those are the leaders at state level that review educational materials, if the state has someone in that role. We also work very closely with the AIM Center. They coordinate the accessible educational material resources, and we have a partnership with them where they had a cohort of 8 states, and those state leaders help provide guidance and input and examples for us to include the important element of accessibility within all resources. And then we also include our private sector annual partners in the opportunity to engage in dialogue and discussions in our in-person events and online as well. So this particular work, navigating the digital shift, is dependent on and branches out of our two pieces of work. One is the DMAPS website. On the left, you can see the state policies. It is an online database where you can see state policies and practices around the procurement, professional learning, and digital instructional materials implementation. And then from that particular online tool, we published in April the state K-12 material instructional materials leadership trend snapshot. So the trend snapshot is truly a conglomeration of the different data sets and the different areas of the DMAPS website. And I'll just highlight quickly here for those of you not familiar, and folks are posting links in the chat, that we have within the DMAPS website, you can click on a topic. For example, maybe you want to know which states host a resource repository. And so you can sort, and the interactive map will highlight the states that have resource repositories. You can compare up to 5 states around policies and practices, as well as sort by topic. You can download the entire data set for all 50 states and Guam and DC. And then you can also dig in specifically to each state. So maybe, you know, Sean is from Illinois. He can click on Illinois. He can see the demographics, how many schools, students, and LEAs they have, and then specific digital learning policies, as well as procurement, instructional materials, and professional learning policies. So it's a very comprehensive site, and I encourage you to check it out. Then, as I mentioned, and as posted here, we had the trend snapshot, and that took all of that information from DMAPS and put it into a fairly short summary document that showed the different areas and the number of states that had different policies and practices around particular areas here: funding, procurement, digital learning, accessibility. So as CETA is a state-level organization, we truly believe in the power of state leadership, and that states collaborating, they're building capacity, and they're helping to support lifelong learning from the state through the districts and down to the school level. I'm sure we have quite a few teachers on today, as well as district and state level administrators. And it does take a village, as they say, and states can provide leadership even when they're not mandating specific resources and or practices. There definitely is a responsibility at the state, district, and school level that the digital tools and resources, just like print materials, are high quality, aligned to standards, that they address the educational goals, and they're accessible for all. And we try to make sure that we reiterate that, digital or not, the quality and aligned to standards are fundamental. And the fact that all students, especially when we look at the digital version of materials, need to have the accessibility and need to be able to access those resources. So in the paper, we really focus quite a bit on the need for students to be at the center of learning opportunities. 10 states now have definitions for personalized learning. You can see here there are snippets from a variety of organizations around the need and focus on personalizing instruction for students. And we spend several pages in the paper talking about the power of digital learning to provide the ability to personalize instruction, the need to develop lifelong learners. As many of us understand, our world is changing rapidly. We leverage digital resources for our business models, for our social engagement, and we're really not sure where all of the career paths will go, which type of jobs will be automated versus not. So we need to create and help develop thinkers and learners. And through that, digital opportunities provide quite a bit of flexibility to personalize instruction. You know, when we talk about digital learning, and I know a lot of our members, and I see some familiar faces on the attendee list, remind us that this is not about creating a PDF of a textbook, but this is really providing variety of digital resources that students can leverage to focus on their own learning styles, the ability to leverage digital tools so that they can create content and demonstrate their knowledge, as well as meet individual needs with a variety of course offerings, as well as content areas that may or may not always be available locally, or that they may not have the teacher's expertise in the classroom. Those were repeat slides. So specifically, as you can see here, there is a great push for states to have digital learning plans. So this is directly related to digital content, because when a state has a digital learning plan and they're working towards the schools and districts providing digital learning opportunities, oftentimes those are coupled with digital content. Specifically, the Ohio Department of Education's initiative, Each Child, Our Future program, provides an opportunity so that all children are prepared and empowered for their future. They provide professional learning and opportunities so that there are the creation, selection, implementation of quality digital instructional materials as part of that plan. So we wanted to be sure to highlight what Ohio is doing as one example of what many states across the country are doing to show leadership and really push the envelope to the digital age learning. Multiple states also provide some level of review process of digital content or instructional materials overall. There are 28 states have a review process. Some of those states provide a review list or a guide of resources that are available to the districts to choose if they'd like to implement those particular resources. So in most cases, the state resource versus a mandate. And this is really helpful oftentimes, especially for smaller districts where the capacity to have someone at the district level to review content in all the major content areas across all the grade levels is a heavy lift. And so the states are providing this service, providing review, sharing best practices around that review process so that they have a more finite and focused options for their content. So just some quick highlights to talk about a couple of the states. Again, we can't highlight everyone, and all states are doing something. In Florida, there is an example in the paper about their accessibility resources. Particularly, they even provide guidance to vendors on specific learner supports and how the tools are supported. Supporting those students that may have various needs. In other states, like Louisiana, there's a real commitment to teachers. So they have on their website, they have not only a reviewed list of materials for the districts or schools to choose from, but they also have a variety of professional learning opportunities for teachers to help the shift to digital and help to choose the best materials possible. In Montana, they host the Teacher Learning Hub, and this is a place where teachers can access quite a few online resources so that they can do the best implementation model possible, as well as they have some guidance of a literacy program grant, so they're able to support their districts. And then finally in Nebraska, I think it was a year or two ago, they launched the Nebraska Instructional Materials Collaborative. And this is a place where they are able to help support and their local schools and districts understand best practices related to content selection. And they also have specific areas where they focus on the Nebraska content standards so that schools are making sure to align their selections based on those standards. And they're also part of the Chief State School Officers Network of a number of states that are working to provide professional learning resources around instructional materials. Professional learning, this is the first year that we have did data collection and reporting on how states are providing professional learning opportunities to schools and districts. And as you can see here, almost half of the states are providing some level of professional learning opportunities, whether it's around the selection of instructional materials, the implementation of those materials, accessibility of materials, or accessibility of technologies, tools, and resources. And we can only imagine that this number will grow. Another area of growth is around OER, open educational resources, where states are providing professional learning around the selection or creation of OER materials. So another type of example that's in this report is from Natick Public Schools, which is in Massachusetts, and they are really working with students so that their educational goals are driven through digital technology tools and resources, and where they're a model for where each child is being encouraged to leverage their strengths and their passions to guide their learning selections. And they leverage multiple digital resources so that students and teachers are building on knowledge and supporting that lifelong learning and providing some independence and personalization there. Another section of our latest report, which this we have highlighted each time over the years, is the essential conditions. We certainly can't have everyone going and having subscriptions to digital content if we don't have some essential elements in place. So of those four primary areas that we highlighted was the equity of access, and there we're talking about broadband, access to broadband and devices. If you can't, if you don't have sufficient access both at home and at school, then digital materials can be a non-issue because you can't The accessibility I've highlighted multiple times and the considerations around that. And then interoperability, this is where the multiple tools and resources have the ability to connect with one another. So from simple things like single sign-on, where we're not memorizing, you know, 15 usernames and passwords, to the different systems within the school district working with one another, from the assessment to your lunch count and attendance or report cards, as well as content tools. So CETA has multiple, another large initiative around interoperability specifically, but we wanted to highlight that importance here. And then of course, in the news regularly now is that whole concept of student data privacy. And we want to always continue to elevate that to the top, as we want to help ensure that, you know, teachers are not disclosing student lists or class lists because they found a great new app that they signed everybody up for without checking the company's policies and practices, as well as obviously the district being really careful about keeping closed their student data systems. So the next steps that we focus on within this are instructional materials, policies, and practices. We only hope that both at the state and district level that folks really consider the practices that help to streamline and make digital learning effective, but also possible in some places. There seems to be a clear indication that professional learning is an ongoing requirement, as we as educators would always hope it is. But as we're shifting to these different tools and resources, the teachers need that ongoing high quality support throughout the year, and an increased focus on personalization, as well as maintaining those essential conditions, because you want students to be able to access the digital content. And in order to do so, access to broadband should be as seamless as access to electricity. And then these other elements need to be in place, and then they need to be refreshed and relooked at so that things continue to move forward. So I did a lot of talking, but that is a really high level overview of our report. I can see that folks are putting my colleague Rachel Jones and others are posting links in the chat. And now we have a question for you. So how does your school or district or state support the implementation of digital instructional materials? I'm going to pause for a moment, check out some of the questions, and look for how you all respond in the chat. Well, it looks like quite a few leaders have some specialized trainings, some of which sound like they're ongoing. Others say workshops, so I'm not sure if those are ongoing workshops or more of a one-stop shopping. As well as some folks here saying that they leverage what their district offers, but then they also go out and look for other opportunities. So I'm just peeking at some of the questions in the chat, and I ask my colleague to post the organization. So I think that question came in early, so it's probably CIMRA and the AIM Center. If we could post the links to those particular groups, that's an easy one for us. Is this a licensed program that schools can purchase? So no, CETA has published a report around different opportunities for digital learning. So we don't have a specific program that we are providing here. We're really giving an overview of digital learning implementation. And then it says, is there a specific curriculum or is it in state standard? So every state's a little bit different. Most states have standards, and then they align their materials for those states that have a review of materials and post a review are aligned to those standards. But I'm not 100% sure that if that's answering the question properly, but you can feel free to submit a clarifying question. Okay. So now we're going to hear a little bit about digital learning in action. So Sean Joyce is here. He's a technology director for North Palos School District in Illinois. And I want to say today is Sean's first day of summer, and he was kind enough to commit to this as the students have gone home. And I'm sure he's regrouping with so much going on, but we're happy that he's been able to join us today. His roots come also from the classroom. He was a tech coach as well as an assistant principal. So Sean, we're happy to have you. And it looks like I need the EdWeb team to get the slides back up. Sure. And I see a question here, so I'll address that. It says, can this if there's a state without a digital learning plan, this can. Is Pennsylvania a state without a digital learning plan? So if that's how the map viewed, then our indication is there is not an independent digital learning plan, and that digital learning isn't not necessarily a main component of a school improvement plan, but we can also get back to you on that, but that's how we interpreted that data. So I am going to stop my camera and turn this over to Sean so we can hear about digital learning in action.
Sure. I appreciate being able to be a part of this. And truthfully, I'm presenting on behalf of a district that I stepped into about 5 years ago, and I've had the opportunity to wear a few different hats since I entered the district. So this is definitely a team effort, and I don't claim ownership of this, but I'm happy to share our journey and what we've done to get to where we are right now. A little bit about me. I came out of the classroom. I worked as an instructional tech coach for approximately 5 years. Before stepping into this district as a technology instruction coordinator, which I'll explain what that is in just a minute, but it's kind of the liaison between the curriculum department and the buildings and teachers. After that, I served as an assistant principal at our junior high for 3 years after that, and I just completed my first year as our technology director. So summer's a good thing. It means we survived another year. We're looking forward to what we're going to do now. So let me get started and explain a little bit about what district I work in and the journey we've been on. So North Palos is a middle-sized district. It's a public school district. It's just short of 3,500 students. We service students from pre-K up to eighth grade. So we have two primary buildings, two intermediate buildings, and then we have one junior high. This is just a quick snapshot to show you a few of our stats. One thing that we do have a pretty diverse population, and we have a fairly high low income rate of 59% of our students. So that's one thing that we are aware of as we put together our curriculum and our approach. The other thing that stands out a little bit is we have a 34% English learners percentage. So that's a pretty high percentage, and that's something that we take a lot of pride in, being able to educate all of our students and give them the best education possible. One thing that we have seen a lot of success in as being a student in our system, a lot of times you'll see students' achievement levels once they get to those middle level grades start to decline a little bit. We have seen students continually progress and reach their highest potential as eighth graders. So it brings a lot of pride to see those charts go up as they continue to grow through our system. And in addition to that, we have been recognized. Two of our buildings have been awarded National Blue Ribbon honors in the last 2 years. So that's something we're really proud of, and obviously I can't take ownership of, but I'm very glad that that's something that we have to talk about. So we are just a southwest suburb of Chicago, just about 5 miles outside of the city. So we are in the heart of a lot going on. We have a lot of resources at our disposal, but you know, we're kind of half suburban, half urban in terms of just the demographic in the amount of population compacted in a small area for us. So with that said, when I was asked about doing this, I really stepped back and thought about what stands out to me. And we've had a lot of progress in the last 5-6 years in terms of our technology integration, the ability to leverage digital materials to increase student achievement, and what was some of the keys to our success and our continued success. And I think at the heart of it, the minute I stepped into this district, I recognized one thing right away. And that was the teamwork and really the extension off of each other with the curriculum and technology departments. I know sometimes technology can be its own silo that works off. When people have issues, we come in, you know, we work on our tickets. But in our district, we're all sitting at the same table and we're all part of that decision-making process. And it really has made all the difference. I think what really was the catalyst for a big change was the adoption of the Common Core State Standards, and knowing that our curriculum was changing, our instruction was changing. The district at that point made a decision to move forward with trying to inject more one-to-one devices at the junior high level. Give us an opportunity to evaluate that and see how it worked. The biggest thing that we came to the determination of is that there was no canned curriculum that was going to work with these new standards. The rigor that it asked for, these objectives, we really needed to sit down and figure out how can we give our kids the best instruction and accomplish these objectives that have been set for us. Through that process, we really leveraged, our teachers leveraged the opportunity that sharing Google Docs, which seems simple when we talk about it now, but at the time, it really planted the seeds for the ability for us to share things, to collaborate with one another, and just gave us the opportunity to just be more efficient. As teachers sat down at the table, it really made sense to understand that as we were having more and more of these in the classroom, this was going to be the device that was going to unlock the ability for our students to achieve, and not the same basal series that they slapped a new Common Core sticker onto and said it was upgraded to the new standards. So this was really a very long process. It was a lot of hard work, and I credit our teachers, and I'll talk about our organization from the curriculum department in just a minute, but this did not come easy, and it was a lot of hours that was put in that I feel like it made our teachers experts in with their standards, which then I think led them to look at things through the lens of being able to discriminate good material, being able to adapt materials that we had, and really take on the idea of being their own curriculum writers. And I have to say that as I stepped into that junior high as the assistant principal, I was out of my league with the teachers that I sat down with the ability they had to just discuss Common Core standards, understand the objectives. And I think that speaks to the work that was put in before that. So in doing that, the organizational structure that we have in place was key to being able to really have that team mentality. So the curriculum director, as well as myself, we work with teachers quite often. But the biggest key, we've got our technology specialists who are more of the back-end infrastructure, building administrators. And these next two bullet points, I really want to talk about the way that our curriculum department is organized. We have team leaders, which every school building has a team leader, which is essentially like a department chair in the sense that they are certified teachers. They work with the teachers to help organize PLCs, curriculum writing, assessment writing, and they really lead the charge with being able to sit down and organize what's going on a daily basis. Our technology instruction coordinators are also, each building has a technology instruction coordinator. That job has changed a lot. In 6 years, it's gone from the person that would train people on how to do simple tasks or how to do or a list of links, you know, for these activities. That has completely transformed. The technology instruction coordinators are curriculum specialists. It's almost hard to discern where the team leaders lead off and the technology instruction coordinators pick up the work, because most of the time they're sitting at the table together. We've really seen them being able to take a task, understand what's needed, and infuse technology as a way to make it efficient and accessible. And I think that's really where their biggest value is, in terms of being able to just ease the transition of maybe the teachers knowing what they want to accomplish and them being able to say, well, here's an idea of how it could work with what we've got at our disposal. So along with the teachers I just spoke about before, they really are they're in the trenches every day. And I feel like they're the people that have truly transformed our culture as far as technology goes. So in 2014, we had created a 3-year plan for our technology integration and our plan to implement devices. At that point, we just knew we wanted to get as many devices as possible in kids' hands. And we had a one-to-one program in our junior high. We had carts available in our intermediate buildings. And every year we kept adding a new set of Chromebooks is the device that we use. And you can see that the technology integration that we are speaking of here, a lot of it was that looking at the SAMR model, we looked at the substitution, the augmentation, being able to just create things with technology that we had previously done with, pencil and paper, and just trying to embed that idea that it's replacing what we have formerly done this way, and really getting the practice down. And I feel like we accomplished these goals from 2014, 2017. We have seen a huge shift. There's no complaints about using computers anymore. This is what we do. And nobody expects there to be the ability to complain about it, because it's just inherent in the culture that we've created now. So to fast forward and to show you what we do now, I don't always get to use this action pic of myself, but this was actually from a picture of a coding club that I taught when I was working in the instructional role. But as it stands right now, we've got our pre-K classrooms have smart boards, and it should be K-2 is actually a 2-to-1 ratio of touchscreen Chromebooks. And then 3rd grade through 8th grade, we have 1-to-1 Chromebooks available throughout the day. So no matter where they're at, they've got a Chromebook. Our junior high, our 5th grade through 8th grade, actually take them home with them every night. We've got projectors in each room, and teachers have a laptop. So that's the devices that we are using, and they've worked very well for us. So how do we manage the digital content? And I think that's been a bit of a ever-changing opportunity for us to evaluate and figure out. I think once we established that this is where we were at, we really quickly determined that we needed a management system. So depending on the grade level in our intermediate buildings, we use Google Classroom as the LMS. In our junior high, we use Schoology. It's a little bit more built out for us for that grade level and all the different content areas they have to manage their tools online. It's obviously embedded with Google Docs and Google Drive. So it makes a lot of sense. The teachers love it, and it's worked really well for us. The monitoring aspect, we use Hapara as the way to monitor student screens, see what they're doing, being able to lock down the browser or direct them links if needed. We also have an assessment platform that we use as Edgelastic, so that gives us the opportunity to get quick feedback and get data on kids so that we can quickly take a look at that, measure in PLCs what's working, what's not. And just have those data conversations that we're, using formative assessment tools to be able to measure. There is a gamut of different things that we pull through our digital subscriptions. We don't have any more, like I said, there's no paper. We're all digital resources. So we kind of pick and choose and see what is working. The teams meet constantly, and they are our grade level content area teams. They really come to us with recommendations. We do evaluate constantly about what their needs are and what they're using. And there's a long list of things, whether it's actual content or content platforms such as Pear Deck, which we use to present to kids and give kids an opportunity to interact with that material. But that's just a quick snapshot of, you know, of what we do here in terms of pulling resources. So you saw our old goals are in 2017. What we did is we refreshed and realized, okay, we've accomplished the objective of infusing technology, getting it to be used on a daily basis. What are the next steps? We've replaced paper and pencil. Now we need to extend to the next level. So we wrote our goals for 2017-20. And this three-year plan included classroom, school, district professional development, and district management levels. So it wasn't just what should be happening in the classroom. Obviously, I think that's the most important thing is what's happening there, but it gave a much more wider lens to everybody that's responsible for pushing forward what we want to accomplish to get to the next level. What I'd like to do is just take a quick look. I'm not going to read through all these. You can obviously see them, but if I go to the next slide, I'm going to show you just an example. So the first goal, which I said I think is what resonated the most with teachers and what we're doing on a daily basis, is still that classroom technology integration. So that's like a whole nother set of goals in itself. We use the SAMR model, which I referenced earlier, and you can see that substitution augmentation is what we really focused on in the first 3 years of our one-to-one. Our biggest challenge and what we spoke to with our technology instruction coordinators, worked with our teachers with, is really going from below the line to above the line. We recognize that they've done a great job getting here. Now we need to push it to the next step. So what they did is they came up with 7 different goals that in the spirit of following them would get us above the line. So I know you can't see that chart, so I'm going to go and give you a better view of what those 8 goals are. They made a really nice infographic. So digitally, they did a great job on the graphic design. My graphic design doesn't look as good, but it gives you the idea of what it is. So what we did is we sat down with our instructional groups and we said, what would be easy to accomplish? What would be a stretch goal to accomplish? Let's start talking about that right now. So in 2017, we had all of our instructional teams begin to start wrapping around their heads or around where they would want to see their energy go. When we're talking about upcoming units, how can we embed these goals into those units so that we're continuing to push the ability for our kids to get a deeper depth of knowledge with the instruction that's taking place. So these are the goals that they were presented. All the teachers and teams, they picked out their goals, they chose them, and then they attached their name to them, and they worked in PLCs to carry out that work. What we did at a district level is really kind of take a look and kind of organized where everybody was at between buildings. We talked about goals that would be easiest, like I said before, goals that are most challenging, and then we talked how to scaffold those goals. So one thing that's nice is we meet quarterly with the curriculum department, which includes the technology instruction coordinators, the team leaders, the technology, myself, the technology director, the curriculum director, principals, assistant principals. They all meet quarterly to review our academic goals. So this was something that we did talk about at those meetings. So everybody's really understanding what's going on. It's something that we know what to expect. We know what to talk to teachers about when we're meeting with them in PLCs, so that there's just an understanding across the board of what those expectations are. And understanding too that we're not always going to hit the mark, but we want to always continue to push and evaluate and learn from our mistakes. So key takeaways, what have been the biggest keys to continued progress, is that we're always progressing. But I think the biggest thing is, you know, practice what you preach. I think one of the defining factors that I saw our teachers buy into being able to use technology, and specifically our Google apps, was that our leaders used Google apps, and it was a question thing. Like, this is the expectation. So we're going to start, you know, we're going to share everything through Google Docs. We are going to use them as a way to efficiently share and collaborate. Nobody at the table is going to say, I can't do this. It's just going to be, if you have a question, let us know, because we are all up to speed. We're working on this. And I felt like from day one, it was in a very positive tone too. I don't mean to say it in a way that this is what we're doing, and it came off as an authoritarian, but it came off as very collaborative. Like, we want to do this because it works better for us to collaborate. So that was a big deal. The other part of that was creating curriculum and assessments, and not using a bank of pre-made assessments, but rather creating our own based off of what the standards were. That created such a great sense of ownership, pride, and knowledge among our team members. Like I referenced before, I sit down in a PLC with teachers and I just sit back and listen, because their knowledge base is impressive. It is, to say the least. So they're the ones that are really driving those conversations. And I've seen the other end of that, and it's night and day. So I think giving them the keys to be the decision makers along with our curriculum people was huge. I mentioned the idea of also knowing that we are not going to hit the mark all the time. Failure is something that we all are going to experience. And I think that's the benefit of working in a team, a supportive team, that we figure it out. Because as a team, we're not going to fail, even if it's a momentary failure. We are going to continue to progress and succeed. We just need to figure out what the next step is. So this whole journey with moving digitally, with moving to a one-to-one scenario, we've tried to be as transparent with our goals and just allow teachers to know what's going on, know what to expect. This is what we're thinking. Anytime we're going to make a change, our administration has really tried to pilot everything. I don't think we've done anything since I've been here in this district without piloting it, testing it out, getting feedback, and being able to address that before we're saying, this is what we're doing. Because by the time we get to the decision, everybody is involved and everybody has had experience to say, this is my opinion about this and this is why. And I think that's extremely valuable, because no change is going to really be successful if you don't have the buy-in. And then the last thing that I will say is that it's easy to get caught up in, we're going to do this because this is what they're doing, or this is what we should be doing. But at the end of the day, it's got to be best for our kids, or we don't have to do it. Because if it's not best for them, the rationale is out the window. So I think sometimes it's always good to take that step back and just realize, even those difficult moments when we have had pushback towards doing things, to say, hey, this is what's best for kids, because this is the environment and this is what our kids need in order to be successful in the future. So that's something that we need to honor and uphold, whether our personal opinion aligns with that or not. So that's a quick glimpse. There's a lot that goes into our district, but I appreciate being able to share that with you.
Well, Sean, this is great. And I mean, you definitely gave a lot of key takeaways that are highlighted in Navigating the Digital Shift. One is the collaboration amongst the digital learning side and the curriculum folks. the importance for teacher support and buy-in as well. And I wanted to, we have a few minutes, so there are some questions in the chat as well as in our question tool, but I just wanted to ask you about your community, the local community and the parents. How did you create the buy-in with those folks?
So we had a lot of parent meetings. Those first few years of the one-to-one initiative, we would meet with every single parent that was going to receive a device, or a student was going to be receiving a device, to answer any questions, understand the rationale. And that was a lot of work. I remember holding parent meetings about six times a week in August. As we would start the year and get everybody on board, and even a one-to-one conversation that would take a half hour, it was so worth the time to just get in front of that and let them understand what was going on. Once they did and they saw what the kids were doing, and I never really had a whole lot of pushback. I think that they saw the value in it, and they quickly could. Well, one thing that was really a big benefit was the transparency that they received by being able to see what was going on with their students and have that instant feedback of, oh, I see what they're doing in class. This is their, you know, grade book. This is the ability for me to communicate in a much easier way than picking up the phone and leaving a message. So.
Gotcha. Great. Now, one question we had from earlier was about lesson plans. What do the lesson plans look like? Are they different? I'm guessing you have them online now versus their previous lesson plan.
Yeah. One thing that we have transitioned to, we realized that a lot of teachers were doing, they were meeting all the time for not even planned PLCs, but impromptu planning all the time. And we thought, why are we making them do double work? If they're putting together lesson plans, we're going to provide that time for them to be able to have protected plan time. Multiple periods in a given week. And what happens is we have a team leader that actually sits with them. They work through it together. So they actually have a team plan that ensures that consistency of a lesson plan that all teachers, you know, will use. And I think it's just another extension of the teamwork, so that it's not like we've got eight teachers who are all teaching to the same thing and making up their own lesson plans. Since they're doing the same thing, it gives them the opportunity then when they come into PLCs to have a really good conversation, knowing that they use the same instructional approach, and protecting that time for them really was helpful to, you know, help them see the benefit of doing it.
Great. Yeah. And then just quickly, two more quick questions. One was about special education. You mentioned the accessibility for all. So it sounds like I don't know if your students are streamlined and in an inclusion model, or do your special education teachers work collaboratively with the traditional ed teachers? But some teachers on the line today are looking to help support their special education students with digital tools.
Well, I think that's a huge advantage. I mean, the majority of our teachers do co-teach with our general ed teachers in an inclusion model. We have self-contained rooms as well. But what's been nice is you have options. You have options to be able to, those accessibility features that come with the devices. And we have students that, you know, there's not a one size fits all device for every student. And we've had to have those conversations that if a student needs a tablet because it provides something different than what maybe our typical Chromebook does, then that's something that we were able to accommodate. And I think,
great.
You know, there's definitely plenty of options with whether it's text to speech, line reader, magnification, you know, that I think we are always able to find an answer to what the students' needs are.
Great. Okay. And you probably have seen there is a debate going on in our chat about handwriting and teaching cursive. And that's probably a whole other webinar on the research around that. But some folks at the top of the call were wondering, since you had keyboarding as a goal, is there handwriting taught in your district at all anymore?
as far as cursive goes, that is not something that we have spent our time on. We do understand the fact that we want our students to be proficient. If we're gonna be expecting them to type on a laptop keyboard, there was a lot of debate about that. I'm not gonna lie, but I think we have continued to pilot a few different programs. We actually are in the process of kind of narrowing it down between two for our first through third graders that we want to move forward with, because it is important. And I think that's a skill that is replacing the cursive tradition. But I am not going to, try to.
Yeah, no, we're not going to jump into that. But are your primary students taught handwriting at all? Like, that was one of the questions from way back at the top of the chat there.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay, great. So we definitely wish we had more time to kind of dig in, and maybe next time we can have a teacher kind of share about the way that they've leveraged this in the classroom. But this is a great way to learn about digital learning in action and kind of highlight one of the examples that's in the Navigating the Digital Shift. Hopefully someone can post the link to the report. And I want to thank Sean for taking the time in a crazy end of the school year to pull this presentation together and plan with us. And if you have questions, they've been posting in the chat, you can reach us on Twitter or via email, and we can share more with each of you. We hope you join the online community. And again, thank you to the Gates Foundation, and for your attendance. Thanks, everyone. Have a great evening or afternoon if you're on the West Coast. And we had lots of international folks as well. And also stay informed, continue to follow CETA, and we will share more resources coming this summer on selecting quality materials and access to states that provide review lists. We're going to be hosting a new database. So looking forward to more. So thanks, everyone.
We hope you enjoyed this EdWeb podcast. If you'd like to receive a CE certificate, you must watch the video recording and take the corresponding CE quiz. Recordings and quizzes can be found in the EdWebinar archives. Please visit home.edweb.net/podcasts for more information.